Queens Boulevard, 1970. A velvet wallpapered Italian restaurant called Bonavia opens its doors, and an 11-year-old boy starts washing dishes on tomato boxes in the storage room. He watches his father, the original restaurant man, navigate meat markets at dawn, where prostitutes work the corners and mob connections grease the wheels. This isn't the glamorous chef as rock star world we know today. This is blue-collar survival, where restaurant owners wouldn't dare eat in their own dining rooms while customers were present. The boy is embarrassed to tell his friends what his family does for a living. He dreams of escape, of becoming anyone but a restaurant man. Yet, decades later, Joe Bastianich would build a global culinary empire spanning over 30 restaurants, fundamentally reshaping how America understands Italian cuisine. How does someone run from their destiny only to embrace it completely? The answer lies in understanding that the restaurant business isn't really about food at all. It's about identity, obsession, and the peculiar madness required to succeed in an industry designed to break you. Summer vacations meant enduring multiple enormous Italian meals daily, taking notes at wineries and sleeping in hot cars. For a kid trying to be American, these trips felt like torture. But visiting winemaking legends like Angelo Gaia and Bruno Giacosa planted crucial seeds. These men lived in beautiful homes surrounded by their creations, powerful figures who had built something transcending commerce. That image stuck. I want to be them. The real revelation came in communist Yugoslavia, visiting family in Istria. Sleeping on an outhouse roof under impossible stars, eating grilled calamari with perfect char, crab risotto where each rice kernel sang its own note, precious red mullet that tasted like the sea itself. These weren't just meals. They were indelible flavor memories that would later define authentic Italian food. Meanwhile, Felidia opened in 1981, introducing New Yorkers to risotto, puntarelle, and buffalo mozzarella, foods that seemed exotic in a city that only knew spaghetti and meatballs. This was the birth of modern Italian-American dining, though young Bastianich couldn't appreciate it yet. He was too busy trying to escape. Boston College offered escape from the restaurant destiny trading family obligation for philosophy seminars with Jesuits who questioned freedom and authority. By sophomore year, Brooks Brothers replaced tie-dye, though those years weren't wasted. Lessons about organic food and environmental consciousness would later influence every restaurant decision. Wall Street seemed like ultimate freedom. Fresh out of college, he lied on his resume about being Felidia's wine buyer, impressed a bond trader with genuine Aldo Conterno Barolo knowledge, and suddenly lived in Battery Park City wearing custom English suits. But the culture felt soulless. Skimmers, creating nothing while living off percentages of others' transactions. The breaking point came on his 21st birthday at Odeon, surrounded by coked-up colleagues, realizing he shared nothing with people whose only passion was money. When that bonus cleared, he bought a one-way ticket to Italy. Sometimes you must run toward something before running back to what you were meant to do all along. In Montalcino, staying with the Sinelli Colombini family crystallized everything. A vertical tasting spanning 20 years revealed time captured in liquid. The current vintage screamed of bloody raw meat and violets, while the 71 had evolved into blackberry brandy and autumn leaves. Traveling through Tuscany revealed the profound connection between place and taste. Saltless bread, bistecca a la Fiorentina, and simple tomatoes created perfect harmony with local wines. Italy isn't one place. It's thousands of small places, each with specific smells and flavors speaking directly of their origin. The truth? No bottle costs more than $5 to make. The wine industry thrives on consumer insecurity and mystique, not inherent value. Wine makes no fiscal sense as a business. Yet having your name on a bottle carries heavy responsibility. It's like music or literature, transcending our humanity. Through wine, you propagate family legacy, bringing children back to ancestral lands. Returning to New York in early 1992 during a recession, the mission became clear. Take the passionate, pure ideas absorbed in Italy and transform them into something that could survive downturns, yet thrive when times improved. A menu is a restaurant's constitution. Grease stains or misspellings are deal breakers. When Babbo opened, critics balked at the lack of Italian staples and loud rock music. But the vision created something unprecedented, the perfect uptown-downtown intersection, where Upper East Side diners at 6:30 shared space with Lower East Side artists at 10:30. The partnership balanced front-of-house expertise with Mario Batali's kitchen mastery, each partner respecting the other's domain. Early days meant doing the curly shuffle to determine who got paid first, employees and sales tax before food vendors who became unwilling banks. The defining moment, 3 stars from Ruth Reichel at the New York Times, earned without comping critics' meals. Babbo created its own category, becoming the standard for Italian restaurants. The secret? Being both elitist, tough to get in, and populist, not prohibitively expensive. Block primetime tables, reward people who appreciate the experience, and create the right mix. Successful people want to be surrounded by other successful people, not snobbery, just curation. 50,000 square feet, combining restaurants and grocery stores, Eataly became New York's first piazza for food and wine, uniting hipsters and retirees through passion for Italian cuisine. Oscar Farinetti, an Italian businessman who made his fortune in consumer electronics, invested in his true passions: wineries, cheese producers, and a revolutionary grocery store where every department has its own themed restaurant. Secured during the 2008 banking crisis at the old toy building on Fifth Avenue, Eataly opened in 2010. It defies categorization: a $2 espresso or a $150 meal at Manzo. This democratic approach, celebrating producers rather than creating private labels, established transparent connections between customers and makers. First-year sales hit $80 million combined. Not every venture succeeded. Bistro du Vent was a complete fucking failure, costing a year and $1 million, teaching that authenticity matters. Customers can smell when something is contrived. The tragedy of being restaurant man: you can't enjoy restaurants anymore. You're calculating food costs, scrutinizing stemware, obsessing over details. You know restaurants fail when owners stop paying attention. Consistent quality trumps trends, and those final 3 tables matter most. Late diners are your most valuable customers. The greatest worry? That privileged children won't grasp the restaurant man ethos born from hardship. The mother who taught, "Never make decisions on your best day and never on your worst day. Make all your decisions on medium days." The father who forged his son with hard-edged practicality, even as immigrant mentality clashed with culinary ambitions. This business thrives on excess. Every night is someone's celebration. The challenge is separating hosting from participating. Restaurant man runs a nightly show where the meal is just the visible part. Behind it, conception, execution, staff management, vendor relationships, financial concerns. Every night, blowing thousands of minds across a dozen restaurants. Then waking up to do it again, not because it's glamorous, but because it's who you are.